Welcome to Behind the Page, the Eli Marks podcast, with your hosts, John Gaspard, and me, Jim Cunningham.
Hey there, Jim.
John, how are you, pal?
I am good. We are back. We're already six episodes in to a 24-episode season. I think that's a quarter of the way. Is that right? Four times six, 24?
My understanding, there would be no math during the podcast.
Yeah, I know. I'm sorry. That's the fine print in your contract.
It is. I think there are listeners who are saying, don't get him started on the math again. We just got him to let go.
And speaking of listeners, I think we converted a few people to London After Midnight after last episode. They seemed to like what Daniel Titley had to say. I believe I gave them a link to the TCM version on YouTube. TCM did a sort of reconstruction of the movie based on production stills and the script they had at the time, which is why when you asked me last episode, you're excited to see the movie someday. It's like, I don't think it's going to be that great a movie. But like you, there were a lot of people who hadn't heard about it. And we now have some new fans. And I hope that Daniel sold a few more books because it's a really good book. And I wouldn't wait for another one by another author. If I were you, I don't think anyone else is going to do the level of heavy lifting that he did to get that rather bulky book out. But anyway, we are now in episode 406. We're going to listen to chapter 6 of The Miser's Dream as we get deeper into the mystery of who killed Tyler the Projectionist in order to get that copy of London After Midnight. But before we do that, we are going to do a step back, back in time. We're going to go in the Wayback Machine and listen to something that was said to us a couple years ago by Carissa Hendricks, also known as Lucy Darling. It was a great interview. If you ever want to go back and hear the whole thing, hey, I'm not stopping you. I don't think Jim's going to stop you. I don't think anybody listening is going to stop you from doing that. But one of the things we talked about when she was on the show was about how you mix comedy and magic and how you can get the most out of both of those in your routines. And it went something like this. I know you have a concept that you call the third surprise about mixing comedy magic. Can you explain what that means and how you create that balance?
Sure. My comedy instincts came first and my magic instincts didn't start developing until late in my 20s. So my comedy instincts were really sharp and I would build this drama for this trick and then I would feel, once you've done like 1,000 shows, more than that maybe, you have this like alarm that rings in your head where you're like, oh, if I said a funny thing right now, they would die. Like, you just know, you just feel the tension. You have this visceral, physical understanding of the room. You breathe with them. You become the room. And when I would build that with the magic, my comedy alarm would go and I would do the joke and it would get a huge laugh, but then I would have wasted that suspense and I wouldn't have it for the trick. And it drove me insane because I was learning the magic rhythm, and what I was learning is that they use the same fuel source. So magic, mystery, is about, I didn't know a thing, it didn't seem possible, I didn't know where you were going. There was story A. So story A is, in magic, is the thing you learn in your real life. Things break, entropy is real, they don't go back together. Or one thing does not magically become two things. That's story A. And then I tell you, story B might be a thing. And you go, no, that's not possible. And then I show you that story B is possible. And the journey between story A and story B is where we put mystery. With comedy, it's the same. I tell you a story, story A. I'm going to use a Groucho Marx thing. This morning, I shot an elephant in my pajamas. Story A, I was in my pajama and I shot an elephant. That's ridiculous. Great. Then between story A and story B, I change it, right? How I got in my pajamas, I'll never know. Classic Groucho Marx. Now, your expectations of what the story were are been subverted, and that's where comedy comes from. So those are the same. If you really, really break those down fundamentally, those both follow the benign violation principle, right? Benign violation is a comedy principle put together by the Humor Research Laboratory, which is the idea of what is funny. So benign violation is a funny thing is some kind of violation. So something that's normal, like a pun is a violation of language, but it's safe. It still shows you understand the language, so it's safe. So a safe violation is where comedy comes from. And a safe violation is what magic is. I expect the world to work this way. You tell me it doesn't work this way, but it doesn't threaten my sense of existence because within this context, it's a magic trick. And so I find wonder in it. Yay. Okay, so they have the same fuel source. Well, that's no good because there's a limited amount of fuel. So how do I make a show funny and magical without them robbing from each other? So what I sort of figured out is I need more fuel. There's not enough fuel because they use the same fuel. So my goal now is to add more mystery, more uncertainty, to have more story A, story B break. And the best way I found for my character, I'm sure there's a thousand other ways to do it, was to make it so the audience couldn't really tell if the thing I was setting up was going to be a magic or if the thing I was setting up was going to be a punchline. So I messed with the rhythms of both the comedy and the magic so that you didn't know what was coming, which makes the result stronger. But also it means me as an artist, I can change that on the fly. So the chop cup routine is sort of that way. The chop cup routine is basically not written the way I traditionally write a script. It's written so that it's like a branching spreadsheet. So no matter what he says, I'm going to make him wrong. That's my game. That's the game. I'm going to use magic. I'm going to use sleight of hand. I'm going to use the methodology behind the chop cup. I'm going to use my words, whatever access I have. I'm going to use that to make that guy wrong in a funny way. So sometimes the best way to make him wrong is to do a comedy. And sometimes the best way to make him wrong is to do it with magic. That's sort of that third surprise principle. Because if the audience doesn't know, based on what I'm setting up, where I'm going, there's an extra surprise. It's not just, oh, she did a magic. Oh, it was funny. That surprise. It's also, oh, I thought it was going to be funny, but really it was magical. And so we get more fuel out of the setups for our jokes, the setups for our magic.
If I remember correctly, that concept of fuel kind of knocked you back on your heels a little bit.
It still does. Even rehearing it, it is so brilliant and so thoughtful in terms of, I mean, I'm almost speechless by it because it makes me go into my own head and start to spin around. I remember we have not quoted him. I don't think we quoted him in the last episode and he hasn't come up yet in this episode, but I remember a Eugene Berger statement to me, and I think it's in one of the early pamphlets, that what's ruining magic is an undisciplined use of comedy by magicians. Mm-hmm. And here is the antidote. Here is a very disciplined use of comedy by magicians, or a magician in this case. And all of us, comedians, magicians, human beings, this is really thoughtful, smart stuff. And if you are in the entertainment business and this didn't make you go, I got to hear her, I got to listen to that again, you maybe should get out of the entertainment business because this is incredible advice. It's just so smart.
Yeah. And the best example, as we pointed out, is, you know, we've always talked about you have to have a script. You should have a script. Please write your script. And she has a branching script on that where she is leaping from branch to branch in real time, depending on the response she gets from her victim or her volunteer.
I like that term, victim. It starts with the same letter as volunteer, but it's a much more accurate term.
But she's making these decisions on the fly. Am I going to do comedy? Is that what they're expecting? Then I'm going to do some magic here. Are they expecting a mysterious thing? I'm going to do a comedy thing. And it's not like she's making it up as she goes along. She knows all the different paths she can take. And she's just in the moment and going, what's the best fuel right now for me? If I'm a race car and I'm trying to get ahead of that car there, what's the best fuel for me to use? And like you say, it's a masterclass in how to do that. I look at it and go, well, I can't possibly do that, but I can certainly respect the skill of someone who does do it.
Yep. You know what though, John, I think you're selling yourself short because I think that is essentially what a mystery writer does.
Yes, but not live and in the moment and on my feet the way she's doing it. I remember something Max Maven said. I don't know if he said it to us. I'm sure he said it to lots of people. And it's a sort of a blanket statement, which is just because you understand how it's done doesn't mean you can do it. And that's a problem he had with magicians, where just because you had the secret, you thought you could do it. And it's like, no, no, two different things, two really different things.
Yeah. And I would also caution, if you are an entertainer, listening to what Carissa said, depending on where you are in your sort of entertainment evolution, could be like taking a drink from a fire hose, because it's just so advanced, in terms of how to do it and what to do. It's something that she has put in the time and gotten to. But if you want to get there, it's a matter of putting in the time, because it's so smart that it leaves me in awe, and also a little sheepish about my own abilities and my own where I am in my own entertainment evolution.
Well, keep in mind, as I think she reminded us originally, you know, she had 10 years of pre-Lucy Darling, probably more, of being right on the firing line, doing magic and comedy and learning what worked and what doesn't work. So by the time she got to Lucy, she had all that knowledge behind her and all that experience behind her. It's not like she just got up and did Lucy. She had an understanding, having done two or three characters up to that point and tons and tons and tons of shows. She was at a point where she was relaxed enough in the moment that she could experiment and figure out, okay, what kind of fuel am I using now? What's the best way to surprise them with this? What I need to make a benign violation, as she said, what's it going to be, comedy or magic?
Right. Well, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that, you know, she uses Groucho as an example, and he is one of our favorites, and certainly somebody I idolize and look up to. And I know you feel strongly about Groucho and his abilities. Groucho could do that. I don't know that Groucho could have articulated it the way Carissa just did. So Groucho had the bandwidth and the ability to do exactly what she's talking about, but I don't think he could have explained it the way she just explained it, which to me is a whole different level of being able to. So yes, I agree that she had a backlog of performance abilities and flight time to get to that place, but I feel like I've had a lot of flight time. I'm not to that place. And so I can really appreciate somebody who is A, at that place, Groucho, and B, able to articulate it in a way that a guy at my level goes, wow, I'm going to have to really go back to the drawing board now, because I have new information that I need to somehow work into who I am and what I do on stage. Yeah. It's just so smart.
It is. It is. I've got a link in the show notes if anybody wants to just send somebody a link to just her talking about that stuff from this episode. There's a standalone link there, so people don't have to listen to us blather on and on and on. If you just want to send that link off to a friend and say, hey, this is pretty interesting, listen to what Carissa has to say. Anyway, the thing we're here for really, though, is The Miser's Dream, right?
Oh, yeah, right. I kind of, yes, of course, it's the book. I forgot all about. Do you want to remind us what happened in chapter five?
Sure. Chapter five, Eli met up with the mystics. We had some nice facts about card shuffling in there. Megan arrived with Quentin. Eli tells Megan about the mission that he's on. He chats with the manager, Tracy, next door. We have some fun double play titles for the titles on the marquee, which I had way too much fun coming up with. And then he walks Megan home and is all hit by a car. And that's what happened last time. Is he dead in this one? I don't think so. I don't think so. Oh. This is now chapter six of The Miser's
Dream.
Is that
the best fuel to use right now? I don't think so.
Here we go. Chapter six of The Miser's Dream.
You must have the police on speed dial by now.
Sadly, you're not the first person to make that suggestion. However, in this rare instance, I was not the one placing the call. Harry looked up from his position behind the counter. Given the events of the previous night, I had chosen to sleep in and skipped our traditional breakfast. He'd eaten without me, unlocked the shop, and was ready to face the day. I had wandered down the stairs moments before and was still in a bit of a sleepy daze.
Who placed the call? An alert citizen?
He put a spin on the last two words, which bordered on sarcastic. Someone in one of the apartments happened to be looking out and saw the accident. From their perspective, it really looked like the car hit me, so they called 911.
But you were unscathed?
I shrugged. I'm a little scathed. I've got a black and blue mark in the shape of Peru on my hip, and my shoulder is pretty sore, but I seem to be otherwise unharmed. I touched a hand tenderly to my hip and quickly pulled it away. Relatively unharmed.
And the culprit? Was he duly apprehended?
Harry made some minute adjustments to a row of thumb tips, and then began to sort and rebox some playing cards left over from a demonstration the previous afternoon. I shook my head. The cop I talked to said they found the car crashed into a light pole about a quarter of a mile away. It had been stolen and abandoned.
Stolen and abandoned,
Harry repeated softly, raising one eyebrow.
Remarkable.
He said it had one of those auto starters, which turns the car on when the temperature drops below a certain point. It was parked about a block away and the owner hadn't locked the car.
Foolish.
A crime of opportunity is what he called it.
And there you were, standing in the way of opportunity.
I guess so, I said as I sat on one of the stools. I sighed deeply and looked around the shop.
Other than that, how was your evening, Mrs. Lincoln?
This was a favorite expression of Harry's, and it never failed to produce at least a smile, which it successfully achieved on this particular morning. It was okay, I suppose, I finally said, deciding not to go into greater detail.
I must say, you missed the boat when you declined Quentin's dinner invitation. He was delightful, and the evening was a treat. A treat, I tell you.
Harry suddenly clapped his hands together and stepped around the counter to face me.
In fact, the sly bastard even pulled off the ice block trick.
He knew this would pique my interest, and he was correct. Max Mellini's ice block trick? The one he did for Di Vernon?
The very one.
Mellini's ice block trick was legendary in magic circles. According to those who were in attendance, a couple hours into a dinner with Vernon and several other magicians, Mellini was doing some innocent coin tricks at the table. At the conclusion of one effect for which he had borrowed another diner's hat, he lifted the hat to reveal an actual block of ice, completely frozen, sitting on the table. With a block of ice? I continued. An actual block of ice?
The very same.
Harry pulled up another stool and hiked himself up on it. He leaned in close and spoke in a conspiratorial tone, despite the fact we were the only two people in the store.
It was a thing of beauty. He was doing some very fine coin work, nothing we hadn't seen, but with some divine twists on the old techniques. Really, elegant stuff. Even Sam was impressed. He actually whistled.
Being the resident coin man in the Mystics, getting more than a grunt from Sam Esbjornsson when you performed a coin trick in front of him was considered the highest of praise. He whistled? My tone suggested I recognized hyperbole when I heard it, but Harry immediately began to shake his head.
Like a train, he whistled. Anyway, Quentin's in the middle of a routine and he asked to borrow a hat, so I gave him mine.
Harry's hat was legendary. A fine, wide-brimmed black fedora that had traveled more of the world than I was likely to ever see.
I handed him my hat. He set it over the coins on the table. And what do you think was sitting there when he pulled it away?
A block of ice? I said this tentatively, not wanting to believe it was true.
Sure as I'm sitting here, an actual freezing cold block of ice.
How big was it?
It fit under my hat, but just barely, frozen as the day is long.
Harry shook his head, smiling at the memory.
It was a thing of beauty, Buster. A thing of beauty.
I felt a pang of regret, probably similar to the one felt by any magician who had declined the dinner invitation with Mellini on that fateful night so long ago. Sorry I missed it, I said quietly. Sounds like quite an evening.
Oh, it was one for the record books, Harry said, as he climbed down from the stool and headed back behind the counter. I can only imagine what miracles he has in store for us at his lecture this Saturday. Oh, by the way, that theater manager from next door stopped by earlier looking for you.
I twisted around on the stool, exacerbating the tender spot on my hip. Really? I asked, trying not to wince. What does she want?
She wanted you, Harry said.
What for? For what?
No details were forthcoming. I said I'd let you know she was looking for you, which I have now done.
He studied me for a long moment while I considered what this might mean.
She said she'd be at the theater all morning, he added.
Thanks, I said, still considering the implications.
Well, shall we get started on inventory?
Harry gave me a long, penetrating look.
I suspect our inventory project will suffer if we are lacking your full attention. Why don't I give it a start while you conduct your business next door?
I started to object, but he held up a hand.
Our inventory has sat here untabulated for months. I believe it can wait a tad longer without suffering any negative consequences.
I could tell there would be no further discussion on the topic, so I headed next door without even stopping to grab my coat. I was surprised that the first of the several doors I tried opened immediately. I stepped into the quiet theater lobby and stopped, listening for any sounds of human habitation. I could hear voices, but after a moment it became clear it was a radio playing somewhere within the confines of the theater.
Hello,
I said both loudly and tentatively. A moment later, my call was echoed by a distant, hello? Seconds later, Tracy peered around a corner, a smile breaking across her face when she saw it was me. Oh, hi, she said as she crossed toward me quickly. Did I leave the door unlocked? She said as she sailed past me and turned the bolt on the glass door. Not only did she turn the bolt, but also the latches at the top and bottom of the door. She gave each of the other doors a test push to ensure they were also locked.
Harry said you stopped by,
I began, then realized I had nothing to add to that thought, but I plowed ahead anyway.
Earlier this morning?
Yeah, she said, turning away from the final door once she was satisfied it was secure. She realized I had just observed her check 5 doors right in a row.
Sorry, she said with a shrug. I think this whole Tyler James thing has me a little spooked.
Understandably.
She ran a hand through her hair, which today looked properly combed and coiffed.
I just wanted to let you know I went down and talked to the homicide detective this morning, first thing.
How'd it go?
She playfully swatted the question away with her hand.
Piece of cake, she said. In fact, I think I bored him.
I'm glad it wasn't the ordeal you thought it might be.
Not at all.
We stood there, awkwardly, having quickly exhausted our supply of conversational gambits. And then a thought occurred to me. You know, I began, glancing around the lobby, as long as you're here, I'm wondering if I could ask a quick favor.
Sure thing.
It has to do with the murder, I continued slowly. This is hard to explain, but for reasons I don't completely fathom, I'll be talking to a number of suspects in the case this week. Might be helpful if I took a closer look at the crime scene. She broke into a wide smile.
Look at you. Who are you? Encyclopedia Brown?
I shook my head. More like Wikipedia Brown. I get some of the facts right, but people keep changing them on me. This joke got the response it deserved, which was small, so I continued. If now isn't good, I can do it another time. She shook her head and began to glide through the lobby.
Not a problem. The police finished their work up there. However, no one has stopped by to reinstall the projection room door they took off.
I wouldn't hold my breath on that, I suggested.
Yeah, I figured as much. Anyway, go on up and snoop to your heart's content. I'll be in my office, placing help wanted ads online.
She gestured to the right, and I headed up to the booth, while she turned to the left, moving toward what I assumed was her office. We both turned back at the same moment, laughed self-consciously when we caught each other doing it, and then continued on our respective paths.
The house lights were on in the auditorium, but it was a dim climb to the top of the stairs to the projection booth. The large metal door had been set awkwardly against the back wall, and the booth consisted of an open doorway with inky blackness beyond. I reached an arm slowly around the door frame and felt delicately for the light switch, hoping against hope the lights weren't controlled by a string dangling somewhere in the middle of the dark room. My fingers fumbled and then found pay dirt. I flipped one of two switches, and the fluorescent lights hummed to life in the small space. And it really was a small room, much smaller than I had remembered. Hence the term booth, I thought, as I stepped through the entry and took the room in. The body was gone, of course, as was the envelope of money on the work table. The police had also taken the two film canisters, which made me wonder, for a moment, how the killer had transported the film reels out of the building. I suppose, in his or her haste, they grabbed the most valuable item in the room and made a dash for it, leaving both the cash and the canisters. There was a dark brown stain on the ground, but I noticed the toilet was no longer leaking as no water puddles were visible on the floor. I turned and surveyed a bulletin board on the wall behind me. It held takeout menus from nearby restaurants and an old newspaper article about the previous owners of the theater, a nice couple that I only remembered vaguely from my childhood days haunting the theater. Also tacked to the board was a photo strip, one of those four snapshot affairs you get from photo booths which used to turn up at county fairs and have now found new life at weddings and parties with a budget. The photo showed a man and a woman intertwined, making a series of faces at the camera. I assumed the guy was Tyler James at a younger point in his life, but the woman didn't spark any recognition in me. I studied the photo strip for a long time, trying to read something from their multiple goofy expressions, but the only lasting impression I got was they appeared to be drunk or high, or both. I stepped across the room and looked out the window on the far wall with its dull view of the side of our building. Glancing up, I could see I had left the light on in my living room, but the window offered a far less expansive view of my space than my window offered of the booth. I stared up for several seconds, but the only valuable information I took away was that my living room ceiling was in desperate need of repainting. I turned and surveyed the booth from this new angle, hoping to see something, anything, which might spark an idea. I scanned the room for several long seconds, but nothing jumped out at me. Whatever secrets the room had, it was keeping them to itself. I moved past the large projector, which blocked access to one of the square holes that looked into the auditorium. The other hole had only the Blu-ray cart in front of it, providing enough space for me to lean over it and peer down into the theater. It was a long way from the booth to the screen, farther than I might have guessed. The curtains were open, revealing the large blank white screen with a small stage platform in front of it. Red exit lights shone on either side of the screen, reminding me there was one other location in the theater I should check out if I wanted to be thorough in my ersatz investigation. I parted the curtains, which led to the exit on the left side of the screen, stepping immediately back into darkness. My hand groped in front of me until I felt the door, which opened with a quick push of its center bar. Sunlight poured in, and I squinted at the sudden brightness. I stood in the doorway while my eyes adjusted to the light, thinking the killer hadn't had to deal with this sudden change in light levels. Would have been dark, with only the alley lights and the reflection of light off the snow providing illumination. Of course, on a bright moonlit night, that can be more than enough light to see quite a distance. The view from the exit doorway didn't offer any immediate answers as to why the killer had stepped out or why he then turned around and stepped back into the theater. Perhaps he had seen someone, or perhaps someone had seen him. Whatever it was enough to force him back into the theater in search of another form of egress. Retracing those steps, I moved back into the building, once again parting the curtains and stepping into the auditorium, as the exit door slammed shut behind me. My eyes reacted to the sudden low level of light, and I squinted into the large space. My attention was drawn back up to the booth. I had forgotten to turn off the lights, which were visible through the two square holes in the back wall, as well as through the now doorless entryway. That meant another hike all the way back up there. I grumbled to myself as I started up the aisle. "You solved the mystery?" I looked over to see Tracy silhouetted in the lobby doorway. "Not even close. And like a moron, I left the lights on up in the booth." "Don't worry about it," she laughed. "I have to go up there and test tonight's discs. Want me to unlock the lobby doors for you? Or do you have more clues to ferret out?" "Don't bother. I'm done here. I'll just go out the back," I added, gesturing to the exit over my shoulder. "Thanks for letting me play detective." "Come over and play with me whenever you like," she said with a laugh, as she turned and headed back toward her office. I considered the implications of this offer for a moment, and then quickly made my way back to the magic shop, this time via the alley. It was a short walk, but I really wished I had brought my coat. I entered the magic shop's back room, expecting to see Harry in the midst of counting and cataloging the hundreds of products we carry. His filing system, such as it is just this side of haphazard, with most of the products stored and labeled in a manner that makes sense only to him, or not. But instead, I discovered him seated at his desk, his feet up, happily paging through a book. He looked up when he heard me enter.
"Buster, this is wonderful, simply wonderful."
I didn't recognize the book he was reading. "A new book?"
"Yes, certainly, but also an instant classic. Quentin Moon gave it to me. It's an advanced copy of his new book on magic theory." "Don't worry," he said, probably reacting incorrectly to the pained expression on my face. "You can read it as soon as I'm done with it."
"What happened to inventory? I thought it was a priority."
"Priorities shift," he said without looking up. "We'll get to inventory later, or tomorrow, or later tomorrow."
Before I could comment on the likelihood of that alleged event, my phone twittered. I pulled it out and scanned the incoming text, finishing up my reading with a small exclamation.
"Fan mail from some flounder?" Harry asked, as he licked his index finger and delicately turned a page in the book.
The question was one of his favorite phrases from the old Rocky and Bullwinkle cartoons he had watched with me when I was a kid, laughing at jokes it would take me years to comprehend. "The police have finished their first interview, and now it's my turn. And it's with Clifford Thomas." At the sound of this name, Harry lowered the book.
"Clifford Thomas? You're going to talk to Clifford Thomas? The Clifford Thomas?"
I re-looked at the text from Deirdre. "That would appear to be the case," I said. Harry's eyes twinkled.
"Any chance you could get a book or two autographed for me?"
All right, Clifford Thomas. I'll just put in a little, there's a little Easter egg in here that I'm just going to tell folks about. When we meet Clifford Thomas in Chapter 7, he mentions, I believe, his ex-wife briefly in her success as a writer. His ex-wife is Barbara Thomas, who is the lead in The Ripperologists. And she's
are you kidding?
She's a best-selling author. Yeah, that's a little Easter egg that they are those two. That's one of the two connections between the two series. The other one is that Uncle Harry's good friend is McHugh, who's the key Ripperologist in that book. And McHugh will show up in the Linking Rings book. But yeah, those two universes are connected for the first time via Clifford Thomas.
And I know both those universes, and I didn't know that.
Oh, it's so. Just me goofing around.
And there it is right there. So when I said up above before we read the chapter that you're selling yourself short, you just proved that I'm right and you're wrong.
Yeah. All right. That's bound to happen once every 66 years. All right. Next episode, I'm going to jump ahead. Enough of praising me. I can listen to that all day. Next episode, we have a guest who was recommended to us by a guy named Teller.
Yeah, and I think when somebody like Teller suggests a guest, John goes out and gets that guest. I do nothing but show up. But John, on the other hand, this is terrific.
Yeah, we're going to be talking to the mind noodler himself, Matt Donnelly. He's a comedy performer. He was a consultant on Fool Us. And then almost on a whim.
Yeah, kind of.
Kind of on a dare.
Yes.
He became a magician and is now a full-time magician traveling the country. He's a fun chat, and Teller was absolutely right. He was the guy for us to talk to.
So next time, folks, we're going to talk to the mind noodler, Matt Donnelly. And you're going to get to hear Chapter 7 of The Miser's Dream, lest we forget why we're actually here.
Yeah, sometimes we do. Anyway, that'll be next episode. We'll see you then. Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye now.
This has been Behind the Page, the Eli Marks podcast, with your hosts, John Gaspard and Jim Cunningham. Produced by Alberts Bridge Books at Grass Lake Studios. Find this podcast and all the books in the Eli Marks series at elimarksmysteries.com. That's ELIMARKS, mysteries.com. And thanks for listening.